Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who's recently spent 3 hours at a children's party and is still exhausted from it. It's Richard Herring! Thank you very much. Hello, my fan friends. Welcome. Welcome to another episode of Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was hanging around with Hufty from The Word this week. Remember Hufty? The Word, remember The Word? She calls it Rahalastapa, so that's... She's good old Hufty. It was a party. Both my kids went to a party at the weekend. It's 3 hours is too long for a children's birthday party. Do not do that to the parents. Some people didn't turn up for the full... I stayed for the full 3 hours. It was loads of kids in one hall with a bouncy castle that wasn't quite big enough for the number of kids there were. And there were kids of all different ages. It was sort of like being in Lord of the Flies, but a bit worse than that. And all the kids had these as well. So they were bouncing on for 3 hours... blowing that, and then I was worried they were going to hit their heads wrong and swallow that and die. It was awful. And after an hour, you'd think, fuck, there's still 2 hours to go of this. And a period of time has passed that is equal to the amount of time I've been on Earth so far. At least it felt... when we emerged at the end of 3 hours, it was 24:39 and super intelligent otters were ruling the world. That is how long we... It was just 3 hours for us, but the rest of the universe... It's the other way around, isn't it? Never mind. But don't have kids, is what I'm saying, is the answer to that. But though my son at 6:30 this morning basically woke me up with the question, do ghosts have bumholes? That was my son's question this morning.
which is an absolutely excellent emergency question. It's quite a hard one. There's more to it than you think. I'm going to be asking every guest I have from now on about that. I do have to thank the Kickstarter backers who have paid to have their names in the shows. Ben Lowry and the team from Eggbox Imaging. I was going to say Imagining. It's easy to imagine an Eggbox. Not for me. I can't imagine anything. Eggbox Imaging. Feel free to call me a fucking idiot, says Ben Lowry. You are an idiot. Stop imaging eggboxes. Get on with a proper job. Mark David. He wants to say hi to my pesky kids, Claire and Fred, grow up. What is this? Not a swap shop, is it? Not saying hello to people's children for money. And Dan Powell, and there's all the one thing there was a little thing to fill in, say, what do you want me to say? And Dan Powell has just written helicopter. The funny biggest laugh of the show so far from Dan Powell. That was not as big as Dibuko Sad Bumholes. So thank you to everybody about that Kickstarter. Thank you very much for everyone coming along. I think we might as well crack straight on. Why not? I'll do that in the next show. I was going to do a funny bit. My guest this week is probably best known for his portrayal of Mikey Dawson in Hoff the Record. David Hasselhoff, I think, is in that. We'll find out. Will you please welcome Jamie Demetrio, ladies and gentlemen? Here he is, from Hoff the Record. Welcome, come in, sit down. Shake hands if you like.
Hello.
It's Jamie Demetrio, Hoff the Record.
Well, David Hasselhoff had water on his knee, as he told me a few times, and that's my main memory of that.
Must be. But once you'd worked with David Hasselhoff, you must have thought, that's it. I'm not going to meet anyone bigger in show business than that. I might as well give
him. I mean, he did feel extremely famous to me. like you feel it, and you feel it on your back.
Yeah.
Famous. Like, I know you in a way I don't know anyone. I don't know anyone who I can only picture running in topless.
Brought the Berlin Wall down as well. Of course, David Hasselhoff. So.
He's done it all.
Looking for freedom.
All with water on his knee.
Yeah. Do ghosts have bum holes, Jamie, is my first question. What do you think?
Do you say that off stage? Which gave me a sec to think about it. I think it's a chicken or egg question.
Do you think so?
Do bum holes have ghosts?
Could be.
I think, if ghosts are what people say they are, which I often think is something they're saying out of their bumhole. I guess if they are inhabiting the core features of the person who's passed away, I think that our bumhole is a core feature of all of us.
Often ghosts go a bit sort of like sheety towards towards their nether regions. They're all right here, aren't they? And they sort of turn into a sheet as it goes.
I actually take offence to that. No more pigeonholing ghosts as sheets.
They're sheeting.
Imagine when you died, you turned into a sheet with eyes. What kind of plan is that from God? Just like, honestly, I cannot think of anything and I am in bed right now. Sheet. How's it going to see? Eyes.
And a little bum hole in the back.
Right, exactly. Who's to say that's not an eye in the afterlife? Don't know. For the listener, I just shook my head saying I don't know what I'm talking about.
And do you think if you have sex with a ghost, would you consider that cheating in a relationship? Or do you think that is... And now it could be bum sex as well. Now we've established that.
If you're a ghost.
Yeah.
is it cheating in a relationship?
Is it cheating? It's just.
Am I proud of that? I don't know. I guess it's. I mean, it's cheating. I think it's worse than cheating. It's like you've gone mad. It's like I'd rather you cheated than sort of started having sex with sheets with holes for eyes.
Fair enough. Have you ever seen a ghost, Jamie? Have you ever seen?
Seen people who look like ghosts. I get. No.
No.
No. I definitely get frustrated by the conversation. I feel like there's a lot of one-upmanship in ghost discussions. Anytime someone calls it out, you can see a person just waiting for them to finish to tell their... Finish. But I was going to say, no, I actually saw a... I actually saw... And then they do that thing where they're like, fucking hell. And you're like, what? And they're like, it's there. It's like what? Its ears were burning. Rubbish.
Don't know. Right, that's most of the ghost questions. We got most of the ghost questions out. We don't usually do them all this early. But it's good to get them out of the way.
I was expecting a very even spread of ghost questions. It's very top heavy.
We might come back to more ghost based stuff later on. So look, there's lots of things to talk to you about. There's loads of interesting stuff going on right at the moment. Where did it all start for you, Jane? Where the hell did you come from?
Dad's cock, am I right?
It is.
Please.
Not just there. Takes two to tango. Because I saw you, I think the first time I probably had seen you before, the first time I became aware of you, I think, was probably seeing you in Fleabag, which was not... You'd done quite a few things before that, though, right? Off the record, I imagine.
Yeah. Oh, what came... I mean, that's another chicken or egg. What came first, Off the Record or Fleabag? One gave birth to the other. Where did it all start? I started by the Fringe doing a uni sketch show. And then just sort of was terrified for 5 years doing stand up. I think I performing live is a good base for me, but I'm just terrified of it. I'm sort of so in awe of people who can do it and enjoy it and have a drink before or after. Like if I have like a thimble of beer before a gig, I'm worried my head will fall off or something during the gig. But so I did that and then. I mean, as far as like TV and stuff's concerned, I wanted to be an actor from the age of like five, but didn't know anyone anywhere who'd ever done it personally. And it just felt like a fun thing to think about wanting to do to kind of keep you going. I never expected to ever get anywhere. But I was really lucky to, off the back of my live stuff, I managed to get write a sketch for a show called Anna and Katie, starring a sketch show starring Katie Wicks and Anna Crinney, and Katie Wicks who plays Carol in my show. That was me for the listener. No one just grabbed someone and just stormed the stage. I'm trying to think of what happened to me to get me here. So I wrote a sketch for that, and then I got Channel 4 were trialing this new scheme called Blaps, where I got given a few characters. This is going back about 10 years now, and I tried out a few characters. Off the back of that, Robert Popper, genius Robert Popper, writer of Look Around You and Friday Night Dinner, sort of heard that I could do different voices and was like, oh, it'd be nice to have a coffee and talk about stuff. But then he got me in to read all the different voices for a Friday Night Dinner read-through when all the actors were too famous to turn up. So it's basically me and there was a couple of them that were there, but I was there just like crapping my pants, like having to do all these impressions of people. But you know, it's called being a swing reader. Like in read-throughs for TV shows, they'll read the whole show out, and they have people on the side who are there to predominantly read in like angry short man in cafe, like number two kind of thing. If there's two in your show, and anyone who can't make it. And so I did that, but I did an illegal amount of prep. Like I don't think he was even expecting me to do an impression, but I'm there being like, how does Mark Heap talk? So off the back of that, I basically became a kind of swing reader for hire, because everyone was like, who will put in a lot of work for 25p? And any time I do a read-through, they'd throw me like a token, like... One was literally obnoxious guy in cafe,
right.
who said, I'll have those when someone else wanted those.
That's the kind of part I get. You shouldn't be taking my parts off me.
Sorry. Well, yeah, so off the back of that, I did, and I was doing that for years while I was trying to get my show about a letting agent, with, I can't pronounce the name of it, off the ground. And yeah, so I was sort of just doing that for ages, and then parts sort of got slightly bigger. You know, I went to Gran Canaria with Bradley Walsh just to have my trousers pulled down.
Okay.
On camera. That's actually something that happened. I was in a show with Kay Van Novak and Bradley Walsh called Sun Trap, and I had to get a flight out to Gran Canaria to do this scene. And by the time I got there, they trimmed my scene down to a line, and I have my trousers pulled down, and then they cut the line. So here we are. And that's what...
But it seems like a lot of your stuff comes from your, well, from your background, and your family's obviously like a big part of it. So I think with Staffelet's Flats, it's sort of a little bit of a homage to your family. And your sister, of course, there's this new phenomenon, seems to me, of brother and sisters coming out of the woodwork and doing fantastically successful sitcoms together. Yeah. That never used to happen. I never did a show with my sister. Maybe if I had, not sure how it would have gone down. She could play the cello. Been pretty good.
Can you refer to that as the good old days?
you had to find someone you weren't related to do shows with.
I remember, yeah.
But it's like, that's sort of weird. It's sort of unusual to... But that means you've had this lifelong relationship with the person you're working with. I mean, you're fantastic together, and she is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Show.
She's amazing.
Really funny.
Yeah, I guess I'm just... I think that, like, in the same way that you hear of a lot of... groups like forming their sensibility together. Yeah. I think like I just had an extra, you know, you tend to meet the people that you're going to make comedy with in your late teens. Is that fair to say? And I guess I just had a sort of 18 year head start, and you do to those people. And so we have a shorthand, and we kind of like, you know, we like you do sort of with siblings. There's a kind of like a positive rivalry a lot of the time that's like just like wanting each other to be funnier, wanting yourself to be funnier, and like who can say the funniest thing about our parents, who can say the funniest thing about our house being crap, who can say like the funniest thing about us. It's like, and you kind of generate a kind of, you know, your noise. I like to think of it as like your noises, like what are the sounds that you find funny, kind of thing, like, and, and I think that having that be in tune has been amazing. And it's just a really, you know, casting is hard. Finding someone that you think that can really kind of carry your voice, or who you can write for, is hard. So having someone is like, oh, yeah, I mean, I know everything already, and I'm just so aware of how unbelievably talented she is that it's like, it's just such a gift to be like, oh, I can just put her in the show and it'll be good. Brilliant.
Yeah. And because it's so much about your background as well, it would be more difficult to find someone you weren't related to, probably.
Yeah, but it's
what I like about it, because I think like the obvious thing to do if you were doing a sitcom about estate agents basically would be sort of more sort of posh white.
Right,
you know, upper sort of public schoolboy twats in a different sort of way, but you know what I mean.
Yeah,
I mean, those characters that are a little bit.
Yeah,
you have
to reference them,
but they that would be where it was. That's where people would go with it. But Staffelet's Flats, everyone sort of, not everyone, but nearly everyone in it is this quite charming sort of innocent sort of fools, rather than it's not what you would do with a not what most people would do with an estate agent sitcom. Is what I'm trying to get at.
Right, yeah. I hope so. Yeah. I hope so. Like, I think that was always my endeavour, because, you know, I don't care about the world of letting agencies. I sometimes, like, catch a glimpse of, like, you know, if I'm, like, mentioned, if I'm, like, in something in an article, it'll be, like, Jamie Demetriou from a letting agency-based sitcom Staffelet's Flats. I'm like, what have I done with my life? It's so weird. But I think that it's, like, that is the kind of irrelevant feature of the show, weirdly.
Yeah.
It's a foundation for a great sketch and a great kind of recurring, in terms of like the tours, like it's a good comedy game to play and to kind of, anything that you can do that's like, anything that you can do where the story is implicit, it's like, oh, I've seen an asshole with with a clipboard and a really scared punter. Oh, he's trying to let her a flat. Like, I know what the story is, and I can just enjoy it without having to be too expositional. And it's like, it's a gift in a kind of sitcom setting. And yeah, but it was an idea that me and John Petrie, a producer, kind of like, it's a voice that I've had forever. It's like a combination of every sort of Greek person I've ever met, a London Greek person. And you know, we were just talking about how, as a job, it's kind of like if you were to take them out of the viewing, would it change that much? They might be more likely to rent the flat. like just like, there's a table. It's like, as you can see, there's a table. Like, yeah. And if I'm completely honest with you, like, I'm not going to say it's got three legs, because it doesn't. It has four. Right? I mean, like, if any, you're just like, there's a slight irritant in the air. It's like, well, does the flat come with this guy? Because I don't want it if it does. So, and it means so much to them. I mean, it's very telling that when I first started this, I was like, how am I going to get into this world that I don't care about and know nothing about? And I was like, okay, I'll hand out a few questionnaires to like friends of friends who are letting agents, like, maddest viewing you ever had, craziest like lie you've ever told, da da da. Every single one came back with, nothing silly or weird has ever happened here. We're very professional and it's only good. It's good work. So there's no, the lack of self-awareness is like hysterical. And by the way, like the kind of charming nature of them is born out of the fact that, like, you know, ultimately, Stath isn't an asshole deep down. He's just like, what's my dad doing? Yeah, me as well. I'm going to do that because my dad done it. What's my dad want? To have a son. Oh yeah, that was me. Okay, cool. I'll have a son too. That's like me. Like, that, you know, the sweetness comes out of the kind of, like, the no thought of it. It's just like, that, brilliant. That's the closest thing to me, kind of thing. I don't think there's anything nefarious going on.
No, but I think, there's a sort of truth that is a sort of better understanding of, you know, I think estate agents, when I've dealt with them, you know, looking around houses throughout the last 30 years, there's a lot of people who are just completely bullshitting. There's a lot of people. It's funny putting anyone in this. It reminds me a little bit of Peter O'Hanrahan, which is on the air character that I actually did fucking create. But it's, you know, the origin was that was a man trying to explain the Maastricht Treaty the day it came out, which was a massive treaty, pretending he'd read it bullshitting his way through. And anyone trying to bullshit their way through something is funny. And there's a sort of charm to this guy. It's like the first time. And how much of that is scripted, and how much of your you just messing around and seeing what happens? Feels like you've just walked into somewhere and are spotting stuff.
There's a bit of that, yeah. I mean, it's in the show, that is the kind of most improv-heavy bit, because you don't know the location, and a lot of the time you're like, get me the scuzziest, most disgusting place in the world, and then you turn up and they're like, it's really nice, I'm so sorry, and then you sort of have to work out things to say about it. Right. So I tend to go down like half an hour before, so I can like know what the character doesn't know before he goes in, if you know what I mean. It's like, because they often haven't seen the properties beforehand, so there's a lot of like, oh yes, is this the pink curtain? Oh no, that's a bed sheet. Why are they hung that on the wall? Sort of thing. So you kind of, and you might like set up the occasional thing, but a lot of it is scripted, because there's a lot of sort of, you know, I've been on so many kind of fake. I mean, fake in the sense that I don't actually need a flat. I've been on so many tours just to sort of like... And it is like... I mean, I've said this before, but it's like they're going like, now, everyone, Jamie Dimitriou's coming. He's going to do a tour with us. Let's give him some good material, because he's struggling to write this series. So be as thick as you possibly can be and lie as much as you can, because he really needs this. And it's like the gold they throw at you for hours. Like, it's even after they recognise me, they'll be like, there's a geezer at my office who's just like you, I'm telling you. It's like, it's you.
But yeah, I think, yeah, but you're right. It's about much more than that. It is that sort of family thing. So is it really based on your dad, the dad character, or is it just that starting point?
Weirdly, no. That was the intention, very much so. But like, the note that always came back from my producers and Channel 4, quite rightly, was like, this would never happen in real life. Anything to do with my dad would never happen in real life. It's like, there is no way Stat's dad would put him in the Disneyland parade because he said the dogs look nice in it. like the things that my dad has done in my life to me and with me is like, you put it on TV and people are like, jumping the shark, every scene. So we had to kind of soften the blow. And then, I mean, ultimately, like, Christos Stergioglou, who plays Vassos, like, you know, we were talking about this backstage. I think that, like, I kind of learned what the series was from watching series one and from getting to know, like, some of the actors that I didn't know as well. I mean, I came up with a lot of them, but, like, Christos I'd obviously never met before. I was like, we looked forever to try and find the guy to play my dad because we wanted someone to be authentically Greek. We were doing Zooms with people in Greece and Cyprus the whole time. And the kind of, I guess, the sensibility that people would often just assume you wanted is, like, I always think about being in Cyprus as a kid and like my, like everyone's favorite comedy show was like this prank show that was like this kind of Mr. Bean-esque figure walking down the street with a big sort of like high stacked-ish pile of boxes in his hands. Like a big one, a slightly smaller one, a slightly smaller one on top. But like walking down the street going like, whoa, walking down the street. And like, and they cut to like reaction shots from the people in public, all looking nonplussed by it. Like, don't keep those in. Like a bit, but the guy is enough to keep the audiences ever like, oh, he's gonna fall. It's like right fragile on the box or something, just like some jeopardy. Oh, it's like they look empty. But like, so there, everyone, like a lot of the sort of Vassos-esque portrayals we were getting were like, stab, don't you dare, oh! And I'm like, well, it doesn't say he falls over in the script. But then Christos, and you know, we saw some good people, but then there was like someone who felt a bit too harsh, blah, blah, blah. But my director, the director of series one and two, Tom Kingsley, who's a complete genius, was like, have you ever seen Dogtooth, which is Yorgos Lanthimos' sort of big breakout film, who did like The Favourite right. and The Lobster and things like that. Okay, yeah. And it's like this very harrowing film. And Christos plays this like demented like dad who's like, for a lot of the film, covered in blood. And he was like, he's brilliant in it. He could be good. I'm like, to play the silly dad in this sitcom about a letting agency, does he still have the blood on him? And he's just extraordinary. And, you know, getting to know him more, I kind of like tried to, he's like so gentle and lovely. And, you know, if you watch the difference, he's very angry in series one and he really softens in series two. And it's like purely from spending more time with him.
Right. Yeah. Well, because you also, it feels like you've chosen the cast of people that you like and you've worked with largely. And they were sort of not quite unknown, but slightly unknown when you cast it, yeah?
Yeah, I think we all were.
You weren't sort of interfered with like people going, you have to put Amanda Holden in or something like that.
I mean, was it a joke.
Well, I've...
Your head would spin if I told you some of the suggested names. But, you know, you develop an understanding of that over the years because it's like you say, we weren't known.
No.
I wasn't particularly known. I had, you know, I was the guy with the teeth from The Thing kind of thing. Well, the very, very amazing thing. But that's purely out of like, you know, these programs have to be seen by a certain amount of people and a famous person is a doorway into them. And I think over the years, you rebel against that when you're coming up, and then it's a business ultimately, and it's like you have to understand the reasoning behind it. And a lot, by the way, a lot of like very famous people are very famous because they're very good, and it's like it's great to kind of like, you know, we had Julia Davis in series three, which is like heaven, you know, and that's like a plus for them and a plus for me. But no, we were like vaguely unknown, and it was tough, but I truly believed them all to be the funniest people in the world. You know, I really, really love that thing where you're like, this really reminds me of the feeling I had growing up and watching French and Saunders and Father Ted and like all my favorite things. Like when you feel like, oh, I'm actually having the same sensation as that, like watching Katie Wicks, watching Ellie, Tash, Kyle, Dustin, Christos, you know, there's a certain like something about them that I just, and I just, yeah. But luckily, you know, I did have a very supportive team as well who were into it. There was the initial pitches of other people, but ultimately we wanted what was best for the show.
I just sort of think, but you know, if they're aware of how the industry works, which they should be, nearly every successful sitcom has, even Friends, starts with a cast of people who aren't known, and then they, and then that's how, but The Office, you know, all of these things that have gone on to be the mega successful things have really not had, oh, let's put, you know, let's put someone in from somewhere else.
Totally, yes. No, totally.
But, you know, you'd think they'd realise. So it's much better to put, that's what it just feels, it feels like you all get what's going on and there's an understanding. Because, you know, it's very much its own thing. It's like a lot of comedy shows that I like. It takes you a little while to tune into the first time you watch it, you go, what's going on here? You know, what's right. This? And then you tune into it, and it's great. But you need everyone to get that sensibility. And nearly every sitcom that I like, I kind of hated the first. I hated Larry Sanders the first time I saw it. I hated The Simpsons the first time I saw it. And you know, and then you get into the sensibility of it and realize what it is, because it's more about, it's the sensibility, right? Rather than who, you know, rather than a star, at least, anyway.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with all of that, totally. But you do have to have that initial bumpy period where no one likes it, and everyone's like, get that voice off my television. Like, it was definitely, there was a real feeling about, like, the trailer just felt so great. People hated it before it even came out. I was getting so much, like, hate DMs and stuff about the trailer. Like, this is annoying me! Like, but yeah, you totally do. And it's like, and but that sort of makes you, but then again, but like, say like whoever you love, say like someone brilliant that you love is in something, and it's just like a cleanser. It just like forces you to understand it quicker.
Yeah.
It doesn't, but you're right though. Like, an original sensibility is unparalleled. I mean, I remember, I always think about starting out and all the general meetings that I would take when I first got into the industry and was terrified and didn't really know I was just trying to sort of understand what it was to be asked to do something or to pitch something, and you know, how all that works. So I was taking these meetings with producers that felt very kind of featherlight and like they were directionless. And I'd always say, what are you looking for? Like, what kind of TV shows do you want to make? And it was around the time Girls was the new big thing, and it was really popular. And the response I always got was, The British Girls, the new Girls. And I'd be like, oh, right, so like a new kind of, some like an original concept with like distinctive performances, and they're like, something with girls in it. Like, and you're like, well, that's, right, okay. But the thing is, if you want to make the new thing, you have to make the furthest thing from it, because the thing that binds the new thing is that it's new. It's its newness that is the thing that makes it so exciting. So to be like, I know how to make a new thing, copy the new thing. It's like, it's not going to have that same quality. But if you don't want to hemorrhage in this industry, you have to accept and understand the reasons that those kind of like ripple effects happen of things. And I feel so lucky that I was able to kind of, I flex my sensibility, I guess, a little bit, and do it surrounded by people who I think are so brilliant and get given the space to do that.
Sure. And you've done 3 series, which is quite unusual for British sitcoms, which I am all for. I would like to see more sitcoms do
really?
More. Yeah, I don't agree with this. You know, I think The Office, fine, did 12, but like The American Office, there was a good, you know, 7 or 8 series of that before it was, when it was very, very strong. So if the characters are good and everything, and you can do it, and the, you know, they, obviously the American model is a bit different the way it's put together, and it's just, this is mainly just you writing. You started off with you and
Robert, but
now it's just you writing it. So it's much harder to write lots of episodes. But yeah, you know, I think it's, are you going to do more beyond this third series?
My honest answer to that is that I really just like don't know right now, because it feels so recent doing the third. I mean, I don't feel like the character and the characters are dead. Like, I feel like there's definitely more to do with them.
Yeah.
It's really just about like taking a breath and going, I've been doing this for 10 years. Do I know how to do anything else? Like, and trying to work that out. But like, never rule it out. No way. I'm just like, again, it's literally like, it's been a few months since doing it. And it's like, I need to break this chain of spending all my time thinking about letting agents.
Like, and you had quite a hard time writing this third series, right? So you're writing in lockdown and in America, right?
Yeah. It was, I get the horrible writer's block at the best of times, but I was going mad. And I think that like part of that is this kind of, the two series structure two series plus Christmas specials, I think, is the kind of the perfect, like, well, traditionally the perfect British thing. But I agree, like, if it worked, like, Peep Show went forever and was brilliant, yeah, yeah, like, consistently. And Partridge has been recreated. I think that that model is, like, very appealing to me. Like, don't feel like you need to keep it in the same kind, yeah, of quarters forever. But I can't remember what I was just talking about. What was I saying? It was something.
It was very interesting. It was so interesting.
Oh, God. That can we get some playback, please? wait, what were we talking about? Partridge, series, more series. Oh, yes. The two, yes. I think that the two series thing sort of makes sense because it's like you go, okay, series one, you're learning. Series two, you're correcting. And series three, it's like, what now? We've corrected it. It's been corrected. And that's why series three of the show is quite like outlandish aesthetically, because it's like, let's just make it really big and loud.
Yeah.
It's kind of like how bands, their third or fourth album tends to be the one that they just want to be good for stadiums, because they're just like, well, I've got a lot of pent-up energy now. but yeah, I'm glad that we've done three and, yeah, didn't stick with two, because I felt like that we did some really fun stuff with three, and I'm very surprised to find that I'm happy with how it turned out, because it was a very dirty slog to get there.
Yeah,
I just went completely bananas. I was like setting up. I found myself. The thought genuinely crossed my mind one day. It's like, if you leave a kind of, I don't know, broom out or something, maybe you'll trip over it, and that trip will be inspiration for Stat's trip in the show. Like, if you walk into that wall, you can maybe be like, God, remember that time I walked into that wall? I've got to put that in the show. I was just really lacking in ideas, because I think that I don't, like, very little verbatim I hear day to day is what goes into the show, but the rhythms and cadences of the way people talk are kind of like imprinted on my head,
yeah,
and then I kind of, that kind of falls like out of me onto the page a little bit, and me being the only person I was talking to for months on end just didn't help that. It's like, I'm not saying anything funny,
yeah,
in my flat on my own like that.
Yeah. But it must be hard if you're, because you're in America, presumably working on the After Party,
yeah,
so
yeah,
like you're working on something and then you try, you know, I think that's really, if you're doing, if you head down in one project and you're then trying to go and write, even if you've got time, which I'm presuming in that project, yeah, there was quite a lot of downtime, because it's a massive cast and there's bits that there's I've watched a couple of episodes of it, and you're not in the first two that much.
No. But to be honest, I really loved playing that part.
Yeah,
in it. I'm a firm believer, having sort of spent so much time doing those kind of bitty things, that there's like, there is joy to be found in not being front and center all the time. Sure. Like in staff, I'm crying out to just be like tenant number four sometimes, because it's just like, you just get to be smaller and make a quicker it's like you're not so exposed. You can just get in and get out. Like I get really worried that like staff's overstaying is welcome all the time. That's why I'm so like, that's why the ensemble like tends to kind of grow as the series go on. Cause I'm just like, my nose is so big. It's filling up the whole show. But yeah, no, I had a lot of. There was like an 8-week period at one point where I was doing the After Party, where I was just in lockdown in the house. So it did give me something to do. But Staff is such like a British sounding show a lot of the time, and all the kind of British voices that you hear like in where I grew up, kind of thing. And it's like not hearing those for a while was a bit tough. I want to hear something a bit nasal. I want to hear something a bit soft, you know. And I want to hear like a bit of, you know, I just want to hear the sound of here a little bit. But I had such an amazing time doing it, truly. Yeah. Like, a lot of the hardship started when I got back and I just hadn't really had a break. And it was like sort of 4.5. I was there on Christmas Day on my own and New Year's on my own,
right,
in LA, just like my eyes getting wider as they went on. I could feel my eyelashes on the back of my neck, kind of thing. Like it was a long time. And then it was like, I think I need a cool off period from this like mad amount of alone time I've spent in California for some reason.
Yeah.
But that in itself, like working with Chris Miller and that ridiculous cast, was one of the best experiences of my life. I loved it.
Yeah, no, it's phenomenal. And Tiffany Haddish and Ben Schwartz, I'd be very excited to work with
he's got a wild mind. He's very, very funny and smart. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's well worth a look. It's a very good show. But I think that's it's sort of. That's interesting, and I think it's a lot of people who do have a big acting career aren't necessarily trying to write. I suppose Phoebe Waller-Bridge is doing a similar thing where she's writing a lot and getting a lot of acting work.
Yeah, totally.
But it's usually you've got a writer or a performer or a writer performer who just concentrate on their own thing. I think it must just be hard to, be diversifying.
Yeah, I always think. I mean, look, let's face it, it's a really lovely job to have to write and act in comedy. There's no one. I mean, it'd be mad to not think that. But the weird thing about it is that it's like there's no time ever for anything other than that. I always think of like my life as a bucket, and if you will, bear with me. Like the acting. Jobs are like these like blocks that you throw in, and then it's like, oh, but there's loads of cracks in between because the bucket's circle. It's like, but then you pour in the writing water and it fills every crack of your life because there's no limit to the amount of writing you can be doing. Like staff, each script I rewrite like a billion times to try and like feel like there's a good foundation there and a good, like, because I want the story to be more than just like Dizzy let the flat kind of thing. He does. No, he doesn't. Yeah.
But there's a lot of work. You can see there's a lot of work going into it. And I think, I've read somewhere about you doing background on all the characters and really, working up all the characters to a sort of ridiculous degree, even the smaller characters, or being very well prepared for it. So I think, that shows in the work, but it is, the writing is always the absolute most horrendous stuff, even if you're not in lockdown in a foreign country.
Totally, yeah. Do you know anyone... I'm always interested. Do you know anyone who enjoys writing TV?
I don't really.
It's a mad. It's mad, isn't it?
But I find writing very hard. I'm writing a book at the moment, which is about my last year, all the things I've been through last year, which I'm actually enjoying writing. Which is the first time that's ever happened to me that I sort of sit down and go, "Oh, this is quite easy," and I like it.
Right.
But in terms of writing scripts, it's so hard, and I spend so much time just not doing any. Feeling like I'm not getting anywhere. Weeks pass and I've got nothing, to show for
it. Yeah. It's mad. But that's interesting though that you. That's interesting though. I mean, I feel like writing nonfiction is like so much more satisfying because you're like I've done a few bits of like journalisty things and it's just like transcribing.
Yeah.
Like events.
Yeah.
So you're like, oh, what was my take on that event? Versus just like, here's some thin air. Try and make a letting agent out of it.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out UnitedHealthcare insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, I really liked in this last series your fight with Charlie Cooper. I thought it was great. Oh. Just because that's, again, the thing is, you don't ever see it on TV where people fight like real people. I mean, it's not quite a real fight in that there's no actual contact between the two of you. Yeah. But that's much more what a fight is like, and it's very funny. And how many times did you have to jump into that canal?
Oh,
and
man.
was it a real canal?
Yeah, it's one of those things that you write down on paper. You go, that'll be absolutely brilliant. Who's doing it? And it's like, oh, it's me again. Okay, it was an actual canal.
It looked nasty.
Oh my god! I like you open your eyes underwater, and it was like luminous yellow. like, why? Is it like 1,000 pisses in it? Like, who's pissed? How is there that much piss in it that the whole thing is yellow? Not just like a tint, like scorching piss. Like, someone's been like, let's get our mates down because this is still blue. But yeah, it was insane. But it was also like, just like being in a wet suit and then having to shower off to get dry again and then getting back into the wet suit. Yeah. It was like hell. But no, I wanted to. Whenever I think of the series, I think of it as kind of like there are like pillars throughout that make me go like, okay, I think this series might be okay because it's got this bit, it's got this bit, it's got this bit, it's got this bit, and it's like the jumping into the thing. I was like, that feels like a kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's like that's the dead, like the bit where he jumps into the canal, the bit where they have the fight. You know, it's like those are the kind of totem poles that I'm like, that's okay. And like the fight is like you get, and also it's like there has to be a kind of foundation to it. It's like, you know, with the jumping into the canal, it was all about people kind of trying to help a cause by doing everything but helping the cause. Like they would literally do absolutely everything but actually like directly confront the thing that they're trying to help out. And it's like, what is you jumping in a canal doing for your tenants? And it's the same with the fight. It's like the foundation was like, you know, like we always thought about the fight in Old Boy, like the one down the hallway, if you've seen that, like, which is the most amazing, intense fight ever. It's like, if you put that through the kind of staff filter, what does it look like? It's like, they don't touch each other. No one's landing a hit there. And Charlie, you know, getting like, me and Tash, Natasha, my sister, saw, before they did This Country, before we did staff, we did this read through for a kind of entertainment format. And Charlie was playing Curtin, and Daisy was playing a different character. I think it was like a different Bristolian character she used to play. And they were just, it was unbelievable. They were just so, so immediately funny, like that feeling I was talking about. And I was like, I just cannot wait to see what you do. And then This Country came out. It was like just the best thing in the world. And having Charlie come on, I've been wanting to work with him forever, and having Charlie come onto the show was just, I mean, he's like, you know, Matt Groening says about like recognizing characters in silhouette. It's like the way you truly know that you know them. Hence, right. Why like all the Simpsons have such mad heads, and hair, if you want to call it hair. You're not getting away with that being hair. Triangles. I'm going to go on about this. I really feel like that about what they've done with This Country. It's like you just know them, and so it's sort of like it felt so exciting to have him kind of be a part of the world a little bit.
Yeah, it's fun. And if you've mentioned this in other interviews, but what I really like about it again is, which is unusual for sitcoms, is the characters do rubbish jokes that people laugh at, but also people laugh at each other's jokes in it, which doesn't happen very much. The thing I think about watching The Office, when David Brent's doing that dance, for example, everyone's standing around going like, oh my God, but like if that was happening, you'd be fucking be
100%,
pissing yourself. Absolutely. Yeah. Or you'd be trying not to piss yourself, but be pissing yourself. So this sort of serious, you know, it happens in sitcoms. Like you've said this thing about, you know, someone, a stupid character makes a brilliant joke. Yeah. And no one goes, how the fuck did you come up with that amazing joke, haven't I? But, you know, but it's just really great to see just bad jokes and people doing normal jokes. And enjoying them between themselves as well.
Totally, yeah. Like, who, like, all friends think their friends are the funniest people in the world. Yeah. And it's like, they, I mean, you know, they might be the occasional person who is. And they just sort of are, because if you're laughing, it is funny. If it's like that deep-rooted laugh, it's great. You know, the thing you're referring to that I always say is that I always thought that sitcoms were full of, like, people making brilliant jokes and no one's laughing. It's like, what if everyone's making shit jokes and everyone's laughing the whole time? And it's like Tash and Al, when they're doing their kind of like thing, and they truly get each other into like a fit of hysteria before the take so that the laugh is real. And they're just like, so that you on action, they're already like crying with laughter, and then in among the laughter, they're just saying the lines. It's like they're just, it's just so infectious to watch. You just see like just crew and everyone with just that dumb look on their face, like I want to be laughing as well. Like, yeah, it's lovely. Yeah. Yeah,
fabulous. Right, I'm going to ask you some emergency questions.
Please.
Do you think the photo that will appear in your obituary has already been taken?
Oh my God.
I think it's hard with you. I think this is a tricky one with you.
I hope so.
You hope because, so?
Yeah, because I feel like I'm worried. I feel like there's always a thing that, do you know what? I'm not going to say the thing that I was going to say.
Okay.
I mean, I really want to say it because it's not like uncouth, but I just don't want to put it out there because someone will try and get the photo. has that photo already been taken? I don't know. Maybe it's... I'd like it to be me on a log flume having the time of my life.
It could be. I think it's difficult because I think, you know, obviously, like, when you've done a big character, that's often what will be picked out by the newspapers, right?
Oh, but, sure, yeah.
But I feel like, you know, the trajectory of your career feels like it's going that way still, right?
He's pointing up, listener.
Pointing up. Going, I'm pointing up with a slight, well, yeah, yeah, a slight
yeah, yeah,
diagonal.
Oh, yeah, it's a risky
so there's up. There's a parabola coming. But you're still...
Oh, it's going down. Oh, sorry. Right.
It's still going up.
No, but I would be more than happy for it to be staff or something.
Yeah.
I'm more than happy for that to be the case. I feel like if I only once got to do a show where I really felt like I was doing a character that I got and thought was fun, that's, like, amazing. Like, you know, it's so... Yeah, it's so nice to do something that I'm like, oh, I think I quite like this. This is quite good, maybe.
But, you know, you're off in... You know, you've done movies and the big TV show. So, like, America's obviously calling you. And
totally, yeah.
Yeah.
But as long as... I don't know. It's... I'm really, really, like, into doing as much good stuff as I can. And that's the kind of headline. That might sound like wanky or whatever. But I really, really am just... I'm just focused on trying to work with people who I think are brilliant. And hopefully, you know, my friends always talk about the kind of... The best things ever are the things that are big and good. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a very rare kind of, like, in the middle of the Venn is quite difficult, because if you want to make something like super duper, like, enormous, it's got to appeal to everyone. And in order to appeal to everyone, you're less likely to be specific. And if you're less likely to be specific, you're more likely to be derivative. Mm-hmm. You're more likely to be derivative. You're more likely to just be treading water with something that's not that interesting necessarily.
Yeah.
But if you can manage something that ticks something for everyone, and, you know, is, like, truly funny and specific, I think that's the goal, and that's what I'd really love to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and if, like, staff, like, no one was watching it for ages. we couldn't get people to watch it, because, like you say, there's not that many famous people in it. And it's like, everyone always said, like, you know, my producer Seb Barwell, and a lot of people have been in the industry for ages, like John Petrie, who produced People Just Do Nothing, he was like, Series 3 was when people started watching it. And, like, the viewing figures for Series 3, like, have gone through the roof. It's like this weird thing where it's like, I'm not watching it until they do 3. No! It's sort of a weird thing. So, yeah. You know, I don't know what point I'm making.
I think it's interesting. I was just doing a talk with Robin. It's about Morecambe and Wise, who I think did kind of manage to transcend that thing that they were. I mean, it was a different world where there was only 2 or 3 channels, and but they got to the point where everyone in the country basically watched it, and it was good.
Yeah,
and it's the one. I think it's the only thing I can think of where you go. Usually, I'd say if everyone likes the comedian's probably not that good. But I think with Morecambe and Wise, you go. Like, pretty much, there's hardly anyone who goes, I fucking hate Eric Morecambe. No, you never hear that.
No, that's Shangri-La, yeah. But you mentioned The Simpsons. I think that's an example of it. But wait, I'm actually, like, I was so fascinated when you said that you hated it when it first came out. Was that a general consensus?
I think with The Simpsons, it was just because it was sort of so hyped, and it felt like it was... So and maybe even before I saw it, it just felt like... this is a thing over from America, and it's on all. All the merchandise was out, and it wasn't really. It was on Sky, and nobody had Sky, so it was difficult to actually see it. I think I saw some videos of it, so I think I was put off that by the hype behind it, and maybe I'd seen the Bartman or something like that, and thought,
right,
you know, this isn't But when you actually see, and especially once it's from the second season onwards, I think with The Simpsons, it does go up a gear. Something like Parks and Rec is not very good for the first season, and then it's still okay, but it goes up a massive gear.
Yeah, I mean, I love that show.
Yeah,
I mean, did you like Friends when it was out?
It was all right. I like it more. Again, I think to begin with, I didn't like it because I felt like it was, you know,
sure,
it was this mass market thing. And then when I watched it, I kind of did kind of
interesting.
Quite like
yeah,
it.
There's a kind of like there's a mini generational gap that I think is people like to me it's like the I grew up like as far as like American comedy is concerned, like my big love was always, you know, your kind of Father Ted, you know,
yeah,
The Office, stuff like that. But like Friends was a huge that is like. Like when you're born, you know your mum's there and Friends is good. Like those are the two things. It was like I just sort of like I'd like eat my TV every day. Watching, oh yeah, Chandler is so sarcastic, brilliant. I was so obsessed with honestly when I was at school. I think I've said this in a sort of written interview before. So here's the audio. I once asked my mum if I could have the day off school because Matthew Perry had gone into hospital. And she said no, and I made a point of doing a lot of leaning with my head leant against walls at school, backward, like I'm leant back against the wall like that and breathing deeply, like, it's cool, he's going to be fine. He could be any more better. I was trying to work out something, I didn't have it. Don't prepare things like this, Jamie.
It's not, you know, it's nice to be a fan of something, isn't it? It's nice.
Look, I like wicked obscure stuff too, man.
He was the best. Well, actually, I don't know. I think Phoebe was the best thing in it.
I agree. Yeah. I think that there are many battles that take place in Friends, but the war, for me, is won by Ross and Phoebe.
Yeah.
Mic drop? I don't know. Could be.
I haven't. I went back and watched the whole of Seinfeld. Me and my wife have done it the last 3 or 4 months, and it's pretty. Again, it takes a little while to really warm up, and it's really good. And the last episode's a bit disappointing, but the rest of it's sort of pretty good.
Sure,
it's pretty good.
Born out of the fact that everyone has a blind spot. Everyone in life has a blind spot. Mine is Seinfeld.
Right.
Never seen it. It's one of those things where it's like. It comes on, I go, oh, don't watch that. Wait, you're going to watch it for the beginning one day. And then you go, how many series is it? Christ. We'll see.
I mean, it's a lot. It felt like we watched it every day, and we'd watched 2 episodes, it felt like every day, and it still took, like, forever to watch
it.
It's about episodes. It's series 4, it suddenly kind of clicks, and it's just... The characters are just so good. And if anything, they do a bit too much with them. I'd happily watch them just sitting and talking rubbish rather than do... Because it isn't actually a show about nothing. It kind of loads of sort of wacky stuff happens, really, in it.
Totally, yeah. I mean, I remember hearing... what is it? They say no hugs, no learning. Is that the rule there? I think there was a rule in the writer's room. There's no hugs, no learning.
Right,
no emotional sentiment. No, the characters had to reset every episode. They can't learn anything from what they've done. And it's like, that's like... Lots of hugs, no learning.
I mean, it's sort of hot. It hasn't aged completely well. You know, like it's a really odd thing watching a man with 90s sensibilities of we're all just going to fuck different people every... Mainly,
right.
I'm going to have a different beautiful girlfriend every week in my own show that's basically a supermodel.
He's scoring a lot in that show.
Well, that's sort of the joke. They have different...
Sounds like a pretty fucking cool guy. Right? Seinfeld. Well, if he's good with the chicks.
it's not as much. And there's lots of things that you kind of go, oh, Friends did that afterwards and a bit more mainstream, but basically the same. There's quite a few bits where you notice, oh, that's the same as Friends did that. Friends did that thing. But yeah, so I think it was a little bit more out there. I'm going to ask you another emergency. This is my new emergency question that I like. If you were going to be put in a chrysalis... And you're going to be pupate, right? And when you're in a chrysalis and you're a caterpillar, you melt and then you're formed into a butterfly. It's so different.
Go on.
You can choose what you come out of the pupa as.
Oh,
would
I
you,
love that. I
what
love
would
that.
You like to be?
Oh,
you
sorts.
Can be anything. Can be another person. Can be you changed. It can be an object. What would you? What would you like?
What
to be?
Am I coming out as?
Yeah,
oh,
difficult.
I really want to give this some thinking time. Yeah,
Don't spring this
on me.
Well, I think it's one of those ones that the immediate reaction says so much about you. Because it's such a big thing. There's a great psychological piece of therapy.
What do I want to be? Is there a bladderless creature? I would love to not have to wee ever in my life.
You can be you without a bladder, if you want.
I'm coming out without a bladder. I'm coming out. Yeah, honestly, I feel like, you know, don't even put it in room. Don't put my bladder into room 101 because I don't want it to exist anywhere.
Wow.
I just hate weeing all the time so much. Holidays have been ruined by it. I was on holiday with my girlfriend recently and it's like, what did you do? Weed. I went to the toilet on holiday. Yeah. In Brooklyn. I went to the loo in the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just hell. So I think about that, like, whenever I'm thinking like what one thing would improve my life, it's like, get rid of this bagpipe full of piss in my body.
And you're still young. It just gets worse.
I know. That's what I'm like. What? Like, what is it going to be?
It's terrible.
I'm just like pissing all. Just permanently pissing.
I think it's the unpredictability. If it was predictable, I wouldn't mind. It's like sometimes when I drive in to London from Hertfordshire. Sometimes think, okay, well, I'll have a drink before I go, and it'll be fine. And sometimes I'll have a drink before I go, and I literally within 2 seconds need to stop. I had one journey into London where I stopped within a mile of my house to do a wee and then had to stop 4 more times on the same journey. I just had some coffee and stuff in the morning. I hadn't really had loads to drink. And by the time I got to London, I had to find a wood in London to go. I was so busting. And I'd done 3 wees and I would stop 3 times at that point. And then I went and weed in a wood that I luckily went through a wood. I mean, what are the chances? in the middle of London.
Lots of surprise wees.
And then other times, like today, I just drove in, didn't even do a wee when I got here back. So what's that about? And I drank loads of Diet Coke today, so what's going on?
But have you ever been in a position where you're sat in, like, say, a meeting with someone? I mean, when I was dating back in the day, I remember being like, I have been to the toilet 8 times and you haven't been once and we've had 8 drinks. What is wrong with you? Where's it go? Are you just pissing yourself? What are you doing? Like, I don't understand. But I it's never a surprise to me because I always know when I'm going to be needing a wee.
Yeah.
And it's when I'm breathing. Honestly, if I go to a supermarket, definitely doorstep, obviously.
Yeah.
If I sip 1 milliliter, I know that there's a big one coming. It expands in my body. It like swells. It's like my body irritates the water and it swells or something. Okay. Is that what this podcast is? Yeah. What am I doing?
I told you it's a good question, didn't I? Good question. Because you can only get something. It's very. I've been forgetting to do it, and it's such a good question. What's I going to say? Yeah, well, you need some kind of furnace in you to burn up. You would need to evaporate the liquid. So you're still going to drink, or you'd have to sweat.
Why does it have to be a furnace?
Because there'd have to be something that would get rid of them. You know, if you're not going to have.
We're talking about me coming out of a chrysalis here.
But where's the water going to go?
There's no logic here.
You've got no bladder. Where's the water
going
to go?
Oh, right, where's it going? Can't we just live in a world where, like, things are chill, man? And just, like, you drink and it's like, bye.
Well, if it just was the biggest of it, and it just every now and again, it was like your water's broke, like when you have a baby. Just you get 9 months and it just goes, but you don't know when it's going to happen or where it's going to happen.
How good would that be, that moment? Oh, my God. How are you with doing poo out of your bum? Out of interest.
They're very good at this.
Poo out of bum.
I do always poo out my bum, so I'm very good.
I have this thing that whenever I eat food, it comes out my arse the next day. It's mad. It is mad.
It's a strange system to invent, by God. That's what I'm presuming God doesn't have an arsehole.
Yeah.
Doesn't have a bum, doesn't poo, but I may be wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's a... when it's good, it's a godlike feeling.
Yeah, it
isn't
is nice.
It? You feel like you've achieved something when it's a clean. When it's a clean. You know that. Oh. I had it. I'm not gonna. Oh, what am I doing? I am. I just. All I'm saying is, when I've done a wee when I've really been needing one, I'm like, well, yeah, it feels good, but there's another one 2 seconds away. Like, this is a lie. But when I've got rid of that, oh, man. Some of my fondest memories. I feel like when my life flashes before my eyes, it'll just be me smiling, walking out of the loo, having done it. Like, yes! I didn't know. Like, it's almost like you get, like, get that like feeling of like a phantom. It's like you can feel the absence of it. Like, like you skateboard out of the toilet and high five everyone you're passing. Just take a spin. Just stand in the middle of Leicester Square singing "Greatest Day" by Take That. Spinning in a circle.
That's
right?
Why,
right, you guys.
That's
have done
why.
That,
that's
right?
Why God gave us the wonderful gift.
A clap.
Yeah, a clap.
What? I love this, thank you.
What else was I going to talk to you about? Well, that, you know, that's there's. Well, I've heard a couple of times saying you got stuff stolen at the Edinburgh Fringe. Was this one of it? You got someone told there's a story told where you got your laptop stolen, but there was a story told we had all your possessions stolen.
Yeah,
was that the same?
Yeah, the laptop was one of my all my
right.
possessions.
You had
yeah.
all your possessions at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Yeah,
in the dressing room.
I don't. Again, this is a similar question. I mean, I'm not going to just question back, but like, the Fringe is like. Would you say? I mean, how many times have you done it?
24 or something like that.
About 24.
Yeah.
How many of those would you say you enjoyed more than you didn't?
I think it's probably about 10 or 12. It's the lot, but it's definitely the second half of the experience. So the,
right.
I think
right.
the first. Well, the first decade of it, it was absolutely horrible all the time, I would say.
Yeah, similar. Yeah. And then I was on stage one day. I'd been having, you know, a mad time trying to come up with stuff as ever, boring writer's block. And I finally had done the show and sort of got it to a good place. I'd done like 5 shows. I'd got like my first ever good review in a broadsheet, and I was elated. I went on stage the next day like, do you know what? This might not be too bad. And then I got off stage and someone had snuck backstage and stolen all my stuff because I happened to be moving between... I was moving between accommodation while I was there. So I'd had to bring all my stuff with me, like everything.
Yeah.
So it was like wallet, phone, like all my clothes. Like they stole my clothes. Like someone had just snuck, it was the Pleasance beside, and someone had just come up, and I saw like a few like entrails of my stuff, like kind of like going down the path, and it was so weird, just like what, like being completely possessionless, just like leaving my show, like okay, I don't have any stuff anymore. Like what do I do when I don't? It's like I'm just gonna go home and stare at my hand. Like what, like obviously I didn't bring my TV with me or anything. There was like a, you know, it was a really like gutting experience because also like everything I'd ever written was on it. But yeah. It was kind of a, no, I can't take anything positive from it. It was horrible. No, but it was, you know, it was just before I started like working in this industry. So yeah. It was like, you know, luckily, I managed to buy some things. I got a wallet, which was good to keep my coins in. That's not. I'm saying that as if it's funny. It's nothing.
Oh well, it's right. So you never found out who did it, and never got it back.
No, no. Oh, actually, I did. Yes,
what?
It was Michael McIntyre. No, no, it was, no, I have no idea, But I hope they're enjoying my T-shirts.
Was it all in a suitcase? Was it all in one bag or something?
Yeah, they just wheeled it off and got back and were like, wow, this guy's really dug deep into vintage shops. This is cool. I'd really like some new stuff, if possible.
So weird to steal someone's clothes.
Yeah.
Just hope I'm the same size as this guy.
Yeah. I kept thinking I'd be like walking, would it be embarrassing for the person if I was walking around Edinburgh and I just saw them like dressed as me? Hey, you look really nice. I love your style so much.
Yeah, it is. Like, Edinburgh's it's harsh though, right? But it really worked for you. This is kind of where you met a lot of the people you ended up
completely
working with. So it kind of works out.
Yeah. Oh my God. But I wouldn't take any of it back. And it's like I do think that a lot of the time when you're having a bad experience creatively, the likelihood is, not always, you know, there are variants within the realm of like having a bad experience. You could be working with someone who's an asshole, for example. Yeah. That's a bad experience. But as far as like creative generation, like if you're having a bad time, I do feel like a lot of the time the reason you're having a bad time is just because you're working really, really hard and you really, really want to get it right. If you're like, if you're going mad, it's probably like because you care so much about it. So often I'll turn up to staff and be like, oh God, it's this scene where I took my t-shirt off when I was writing it because I got so stressed. That was so bad. This is going to be so bad. And then you go, oh, this feels quite good because it felt bad because I was working so hard on getting so stressed about getting it right. Yeah. It's the ones where I'm like, biddle, 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 and like, oh, this is great. This is easy. You tell them, you're like, I didn't work really hard on that one because I was smiling all the time. So yeah, it's I think that like, and the Fringe is the epitome of that. You're like working out what you're gonna do. Like I turned up for my first, because I did like 3 years at uni in a sketch troupe, which is really where I met like a lot of my gang, right. And how like a lot of sort of gangs form. Like Ellie White, who's in Staff, plays Katya. She was in my sketch troupe, and I said to Tash, I think I've met someone who might be as funny as you. And she hit me. no, she didn't. She didn't. She was very gracious. And I just sort of, and they're now on Double Act. I actually literally left filming of their sketch show. Well, they're filming a sketch show series today. It was their last day today. And that's where I've come from today. And it's brilliant. They're just amazing. And it's so lovely. But we all had this experience of like really stressing out for ages, like doing these shows. And then I like left uni and was like, how do I apply this and get money out of it? It's impossible. And just was like, oh, well, I'll just probably get a regular job and enjoy the memories kind of thing. Yeah. And then I was like, do you know what? If I just book a Fringe venue, like a free Fringe venue, like back of a kind of cocktail bar or something, I'll have to do it. Even if I don't want to, I'll have to do it. I'd never done solo stuff before. And when I started trying to do stand-up, I had this weird tick where if a joke didn't land, which was very often, I would naturally just look to my left because I was so used to there being someone beside me to fill the silence. I'm like, why aren't you filling it? Oh, because you're air. So that was hard, and I was sort of scared of coming up with material. But then it came around, and I was like, and you know, I was like, well, look, if you booked it, you'll come up with a show. And then it came around, and I hadn't. I had like 15 minutes of material to fill an hour, one character, and I did that. And you know, it was all right because I'd been gigging it on the London circuit. And then I'd be like, bye. After that, and audiences would be like, hey! Luckily, it was usually two people, so it would just be, I could deal with that. I'd be like, no, hey is fair enough. Here's your no money back because it was free. But then I sort of, a friend of mine was like, just so you know, I'm coming down with like some friends. And I was like, I don't know, that's going to be so embarrassing if they come and see it. And I was like, do you know what? Shut up, you idiot, and do some work. And I didn't sleep for like 4 nights, just talking different voices, being like, what could be a character? What could be a character? What could be a character? Like, coming stuff. I'd pick up, this was on like the Monday, and they were coming on the Friday. And each day, I passed a wig shop on the way and tried to do new wig. It rarely fit the character I was doing. Just like any wig. And then by the Friday, I had an hour because it's just like application and really, really, really like having a reason to want to do well. Because it's like, yeah, when you've got like no one in the audience, you're a bit like, what am I doing again? This is so weird. I'm really working hard to just stand in a room and talk to a stranger in character. So, I mean, that, but also, and that's like its own thing. Like, you know, I'm sure you've sort of seen and experienced this. There are stand-up gigs that you do that are like, you know, a bit looking sort of stand-up comedy, observational comedy. And if you come out and you're doing like a voice or something, they're like, what are you doing? Just make some fucking observations, please. And it's fair enough. Like, I love stand-up so much. It's just not, I'm not good at, I can't do it. Like, I can only do jokes that don't work. That's like all I know how to do. And I've been in situations where audiences have been like, literally like, we know you're not real. Someone once shouted that out. Oh, sorry. No, you're right. You got me, and just like slinking off stage. Like, oh, damn, I thought I'd got them. I used to play a character called Michael Eggwater. I would do live. Who was like a 60-year-old lounge singer when I was 23. Who were like, we know you're young. Be a better person.
But you could say that to anybody. You could say that to a stand-up, couldn't you? We know that you're not really this funny in real life. You're putting on a character. You're heightening your experiences and exaggerating what's happening. You've made this story much funnier than it was when it actually happened. We know it.
You're heightening your experiences.
Oh dear. Well, look, I mean, it's amazing, but that's like an old school Edinburgh experience. So it's amazing that's happened this century, that you've basically written a show. That's what, you know, when we used to go to Edinburgh in the early 90s, we'd sort of start with hardly anything, and by the end of the Fringe, hopefully have something. And I think that's what the Fringe should be, you know. It's amazing that you can, that, you know, with that impetus and just concentrating that hard for 4 days and driving yourself mad, you can turn something around like that. Was that the show that then the next year you kind of took up, and or was that the,
yes.
was that
yeah,
the show
yeah yeah that, yeah yeah so that was like I sort of workshopped that, and I tried out a few different characters over the months, and then over that year I was workshopping the show, and then I took that to like a paid venue and stuff. And yeah, I had laryngitis, which wasn't helped by the fact that one of the four characters I did was a spooky nanny whose thing was that she screamed all the time. that was interesting. But yeah, that was the one where I got all my stuff stolen.
Yeah.
And I went back. So I after that, I started exclusively sort of doing this one show a month that I was doing with Cardinal Burns, Dustin Demi Burns, Subcardinal, who like I worshipped, and I'd written a couple of sketches for their sketch show around the time I'd done the Anna and Katie one. Because they'd come to see that show like a few days after that wig thing. They happened to be in the audience for the show, like tipped off by my friend Rupert Magendy, who runs Knock Two Bag, which is brilliant, a club night in London. And so Rupert started running a monthly night called Moth Club that I did with Seb and Dustin and Tash and Ellie and guests. And that was like the funnest live experience of my life. Like just doing it monthly kind of thing. And then we took that up to the Fringe, and I just did like a 10-minute slot. And I was like, this is how you do it. 10 minutes. I honestly just feel like talking for an hour is hard. Like I really find like the thing of like keeping people's focus for an hour. Like someone once said to me that all Fringe shows should be half an hour and £5, and I ran to Leicester Square, Greatest Day, all over again. Yes.
Yeah. No. Well, I think that's true of a lot of. I think that is true. A lot of people push themselves and extend themselves too quickly, I think, and I think like it's good to do half an hour before you can do an hour.
Oh my god, I've obviously seen some exquisite hours. Like there's been some of the best like viewing experiences of my life. I've been watching hours at the Fringe, but a lot the force that you forcing yourself to do an hour is like it's tough going.
It is, and a lot of people have half an hour that they turn into an hour.
Yeah,
it's not just talk half the speed. It's fine.
Oh, have you ever heard that, by the way, about? Have you heard that? I once heard that I think it was Les Mis, the orchestra were like getting frustrated by a kind of underpay, and they were like, they were being paid by the hour,
right?
And they were like, how can we, if they're not giving us a pay rise, slow down the music. So there was like a couple of nights where it was like, I dreamed a dream. You know, and you know, and I think it worked. They're now all billionaires.
Is what's coming up? Do we? Are you able to say? Is there stuff that you can talk about, or is all top secret?
Is there stuff? I don't think I'm allowed to say any of this stuff. There's nothing like wild. I will say that I started out my career doing some singing. I was in a band, and my live stuff that I did, you know, these Moth Club shows I'm talking about, I'd always do like sort of comedy songs. I was like momentarily a session singer while I was trying to make money in my late teens. And I kind of like flexing that muscle. I really, you know, making the decision between comedy and music is like quite a big one, because it's like, well, you're either going to be really serious or really stupid. And I've got a really big bum and I'm really fall over all the time. So, stupid, please. The next thing I do, I think, is going to be kind of comedy music related type thing, something that I find quite fun. I always like doing things that I'm like, I think, I don't know, in my experience, like doing stuff has taught me that like an idea that you think could be really, really shit is probably a better thing to do, because it's like, because the gains are so much bigger. If you're like, this is a bloody brilliant idea, oh yeah, it was great. But if you're like, that's going to be shit, hang on. It was good. That's better, isn't it?
Yeah. Very much how I've lived my career. So it's that's been fun. Well, look, whatever comes up next, I'm sure it'll be fantastic. Do watch the after party. It's on Apple TV.
Yes, Apple TV Plus.
And Steph Let's Flats is all on Channel
all
4.
All four,
which is...
Hoff the Record
was
on Dave, I think.
Was it? Okay.
Who knows where it is now?
It's
hovering around. It'll be in the ether. It's in the street. It's in Leicester Square.
We'll be able to find all of this stuff. That's the beauty of you being so young. Everything is recorded and up somewhere, and we'll be able to find it all. Ladies and gentlemen, give a massive round of applause to the amazing Jamie Dimitriou.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Stick around. We've got Samira Ahmed coming next week. You have been listening to Rahalastapur with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Jamie Dimitriou. Thank you to Scant Regard for providing the music. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker, and also to Chris Evans. Not that one. Or that one. Not that one, either. Not the Daily Telegraph editor. No, none of the other ones. The one from Go Faster Strike, obviously, you idiot. Thank you very much to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre for looking after us, and everyone at Acast for looking after us, and for my mummy and daddy for looking after me when I was little. Thank you also to our Kickstarter reward people, who are Lizzie Jones, Anna Kay, Justin Bendon, Ripun Jaisingh Gula Up. That's right, Ripun Jaisingh Gula Up. Malcolm, James Carter, Lisa A, Phil Maddock, my fan friend Elise, Anon, Tim Nichols, IP Freely, Bex Middleton, Holly Latham, Dr. Belbalon, Matt Taylor, Adam Flowers, Don McCoy, Dan Massey, Christopher Davis, Andrew, Alison Jenner, Stephen Piercy, David Telford, David Toiler on the Sea Kid, Neil Hopkins, Andy Smith, Jacob Watts, Jake Anders, ML, Carla Thiege, Kirsty McLean, Robert B. Parker, Ruth Jack and Rose Turner. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz at GoFasterStripe.com production. Thank you for listening. Go to GoFasterStripe.com and download some of their excellent shows, including all of my stand-up shows, and get their books there. Michael Legg's got a book out there, apparently. That's what I've heard. GoFasterStripe.com for all your comedy needs.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.